So this is some work that I've done at the University of Innsbruck, where I've been since last October. And I've been working with a graduate student, Andrea Michelli, who'll be finishing up this summer. And we both work in the group of Peter Zoller at the palindromic IQOQI, as well as some work I've done with Stephen Bullock, who's at the Center for Computational Sciences in Bowie, Maryland, which I finally found the icon for this place, which has an infinity sign. I'm not sure what that's supposed to denote. So the motivation for this work is really just to try to see a way that we can use techniques from quantum information to better understand our natural world. So as opposed to trying to use techniques from quantum information to solve sort of classical computational problems like factoring or graph isomorphism or searching, to really see if we can directly apply techniques that involve measurements and updating our knowledge about a quantum system to understand the natural world. And so the particular example that we'll be looking at is trying to understand topological order. And in particular, I'll be looking at surface codes as topological order. These have the property of serving as protected quantum memory, as well as having quasi-particle excitations, which are non-trivial in their quantum statistics. Particularly, I'll be looking at cases which have excitations which are abelian anions and give a new type of realization of a ZD lattice gauge theory. And then second of all, I'll be looking at a way to actually implement these kinds of ideas using polar molecules trapped in an optical lattice. So many people aren't familiar with what polar molecules are, so I'll give an introduction in terms of the structure of these things, which I think you'll find not too unfamiliar if you've seen talks involving alkali atoms. The polar molecules we've been looking at have a very similar structure in many ways. Then I'll describe how you can engineer specific spin lattice models, and in particular, how to construct a model on a honeycomb lattice that was introduced by Kataev recently that has topologically protected ground states and some perturbative limit. And then finally, well, if you were to give this recipe to an experimentalist, you'd want to have some kind of verification that you prepared something suitably exotic and interesting. So I'll give some pseudocode for how you might measure anionic statistics of the quasiparticle excitations. And if there's time, I'll give an extension to spin one models. So just starting off, what is topologically protected quantum memory? The idea is to establish an isomorphism between spins on some cellulation and one chains or pieces of string. And here the surface is just denoted by some graph with vertices, edges, and faces. And it's an example of this would be n qubits on a square lattice. Here the qubits are the dots, and if we replace each dot by an edge, then this gives a cellulation of a surface. And we can just think about presence of string as a 1 and absence as a 0. So you can think of no string as sort of a vacuum state, and then adding string as doing bit flips on this state. And you can say that states that are invariant under loop operators in a given homology class are topologically ordered. What is homology? Homology just tells you something about strings without boundaries that themselves do not boundary, that themselves are not boundary of a face. So let's see this in a little detail. How would you establish a Hamiltonian which had the structure of states being topologically ordered? Well, a constructive way to do this is to write a Hamiltonian as a sum of vertex and face operators, where each vertex is a product of Z operators, here we're looking at qubits, involving edges that meet at that vertex. And each face involves a product of X operators, where these operators are on the boundary of that face. And if we take a sum over all these things, these two operators, GV and GF, are guaranteed to commute everywhere, because they hit each other twice, and the Pauli operators anti-commute. And then we can define a stabilizer group, which is the multiplicative product of all these vertex and face operators. And we say that the ground states of a Hamiltonian are in the stabilizer of this group G, is the property we want to have for our topologically ordered states. Well, you can compute the dimension of this eigenspace to see if it's not zero by defining a projector onto this space, which is just the sum over all the group elements in that group, and dividing by the number of group elements and taking the trace. So if this seems a little bit unfamiliar, there's a simple example here. If you just look at, for two qubits, the stabilizer generator is XX and ZZ, then the group is at four elements, and if you take this trace, you see that there is one element. So in fact, there is one state that is in that stabilizer. Okay, so let's see an example of how this is applied. This was introduced by Kataev quite a long time ago, back in 97, and published in that reference in 2003. there's a Hamiltonian where it's on a square lattice, and at each vertex on the crosses, you have a product of Z operators, and on faces, you have a product of X operators. Well, on a plane, say you have a P by Q plane, there's a constraint on the number of vertices and the number of faces. So the total number of qubits, which is equal to the number of edges, equals number of vertices plus number of faces plus one. Well, that removes one of the degrees of freedom of a vertex operator or a face operator. So the number of group elements is really 2 to the n minus 1. And when you compute the dimension of the ground subspace, you find that it's 2. That is, you can encode one qubit. And here's an example of logical operations. If you do a string of operations along the horizontal involving x's, that gives you a logical x. A string vertically, it gives you a logical z. These two logical operators anticommute, and they provide a representation of SU2. Notice also that if you were to do a loop operation, say x is here and here, you'll hit every vertex operator twice, so that'll anticommute once and then again, which means you won't change the eigenvalue of that vertex operator. So loop operators that are contractible act trivially on the ground subspace. Well, we found a slightly more generic construction using QDITs, and the idea is to also use some kind of surface cellulation, but now instead of placing qubits on each edge, you have a D-dimensional system, or a QDIT. And the operator basis is the generalized polygroup. So these are the X operators, which increment U1 mod D. Z operators, which apply a phase, Xi to the J on basis state J, where Xi is e to the 2i over D. And there's this group commutator relation. And just as we had the stabilizer group involving products of X's and Z's, here we can think of the polygroup as just going to be products of X's and Z's in this generalized polygroup. The vertex constraints, in the case of QDITs, is going to be a product of Z operators that meet, of edges that meet at a vertex. And depending upon the orientation of the edges, that is whether an edge points away from the vertex or towards the vertex, will apply Z or Z inverse. So the difference here between the qubit case is that we have to have oriented edges. Now, these operators G are no longer Hermitian, but you can just make them Hermitian by adding the Hermitian adjoint. So as before, in the qubit case, we had a product of Z's that met at a vertex. And this term can be thought of as a constraint where if you were to apply an X operator on an edge that meets at a vertex, it'll change the eigenvalue. So if we take a sum over these terms, the claim is that any ground state that involves a chain of strings in a loop will have the property of being a ground state. That is, that if it's a ground state, it has no boundary, and if it has no boundary, it's a ground state. And you can check this just by going through the relations on the Hamiltonian. Well, that doesn't quite do it, because just having the constraint on the vertex operators doesn't give you topological order. And the simple reason to see that is that the dimension of this ground space depends upon my cellulation. If I were to add more edges in my system and more qubits, I would change the number of possible loops I could have. And we know that topologically invariant states should have the property that it doesn't matter how you cellulate the surface. So to get true topological order, what you need to also have is face constraints. So you need to have some kind of operator that acts on edges surrounding a face. And here it's just a generalization from the qubit case where now you use these X operators, where you have to include the orientation of the edges in your definition of these face operators. So as an example, here we have a honeycomb lattice. And if you look at this vertex operator V0, the Hamiltonian will have a term like ZZ, Z inverse. And the face operator around F0 will have XX, X inverse, X inverse, X inverse, X. And you pick whether it's going to be inverse or not inverse, depending upon whether the edge is oriented with the orientation of the face or against the orientation of the face. So we consider these terms which involve sums over face operators as a kinetic term. And you can think of this in a way as a term which causes fluctuations in the strings associated with violations of vertex constraints. And if you take the sum of these two terms, you get a Hamiltonian, which is topologically ordered. And the ground state dimension is given by the number of elements in the first homology group. So for a compact orientable surface of genus G, there's the definition of the first homology group. And we get a ground subspace given by CD to the 2G. So for instance, if I have a donut, I get the ability to encode two qubits, one with operations going this way, another with operations going this way. So for example, I can encode two qubits in a two punctured plane, as this description shows, where the operations involve doing operations around a hole or to the edge. But I also want to point out that the excitations behave according to a ZD gauge theory. So my excitations come in particle-antiparticle pairs, and I can represent them as dionic combinations of charge and flux, where charge is going to be violation of a vertex constraint, and flux is violation of a face constraint. So if I do a Z operation on my ground state, I can prepare a charge pair, flux pair, which is given by these squares, and then an X operation provides a way to create these charge pairs that are denoted as diamonds. And you can show that you can do exchange of identical particles will give you a phase that corresponds to the phase predicted by a discrete ZD gauge theory, as well as the operations of braiding. So let me now talk about how you could implement this using polar molecules. The platform here is polar molecules trapped in an optical lattice. And in particular, we're looking at so-called heteronuclear molecules formed from alkaline earth monohalides. So these have one outer valence electron, which gives us the ability to optically trap it. And there's a possibility of having a dipole moment if you mix rotational states of different parity. And the nice structure of these things is you have the ability to have very strong coherent evolution. 3 minutes? Okay. Whereas you can have very small rates due to decoherence involving scattering from the lattice or black body radiation. So we are able to use microwave pulses to couple the n equals 0 and n equals 1 states without coupling to the n equals 2 states. And we'll use this coupling between the different rotational states to induce dipole-dipole interactions. So the idea is that we have two molecules nearby in the lattice. We apply a microwave field, and this induces dipole-dipole interactions. Well, you can exactly diagonalize these dipole-dipole excited potentials. And each one of these potentials is a superposition of different parity states and different spin states. And by weakly coupling to these back up and down, you get an effective spin-spin interaction between your two molecules. And in fact, by using up to 6 fields, you can get any permutation symmetric 2-qubit interaction. So since I'm getting a little tight on time, let me just say that one of the interactions we can get is this interaction proposed by Kataev on a honeycomb lattice, where you have XX interactions on the green links, YY on the red links, and ZZ on the blue links. You can create such a honeycomb lattice by using two stacked triangular lattices, which are staggered and shifted from each other in space. And that gives you a coupling graph, which is honeycomb. And the reason we have to have triangular lattices is in order to get these interactions, which are XX, YY, and ZZ, we have to have nearest neighbors form orthogonal triads. And this is guaranteed by this structure of staggered triangular lattices. So you can see the coupling graph in terms of these hexagons here. This is another way to visualize that, the game Hubert, where he just got eaten there. So we verified that, in fact, you can build such a system by numerically solving the effective interaction after coupling to these dipole-dipole excited states. This is on a system of 12 spins, indicated by these dots here. The links are give a characterization of how strong the interaction is, depending upon how wide the link is. And the color gives you an idea of the character of the interaction. So blue is ZZ, red is YY, and green is XX. And this is exactly the kind of thing we wanted to have. Notice there are also some smaller lines which involve next nearest neighbor couplings, as well as couplings with different spin character. However, these are less than the percent level. And in fact, if you could get tighter trapping, you can make them even smaller. So on a four-spin configuration, the operator fidelity is the difference between what we obtain and what we want is at the 10 to the minus 4 level. And for realistic parameters, you can get a JZ coupling of about 100 kilohertz, which means that in the effective model where you get in perturbative limits a four-body interaction, that effective gap is going to be 4 times 167 hertz, which isn't terribly huge, but does give you some room to do coherent control because the decoherence mechanisms are so slow in this case, in order of tens of seconds. There are possibilities to make these gaps larger by using self-assembled crystals, but I won't have time to explain that now. And what is it, 2 minutes? Oh, zero. Okay. So I'll just leave up my conclusions. Thanks.
Questions for Gavin. Questions, Kevin?